Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Rebecca, Mark, in EB5, after the EB5 immigration attorney, I would say the next most important person, or perhaps the first, is the economist.
Yes, Mona, I think even more so now with the changes that came with the EB5 Reform and Integrity Act of 2022, or more known in the industry as RIA, R-I-A, it's not just important for the economist to give the job creation, right? Now we're seeing it ever more so because there's an importance of analyzing the TEAs, the targeted employment areas, as well as what we'll get into later, the mandatory compliance for regional centers.
Right. TEA is a huge topic right now, isn't it? And I think for our listeners who are not familiar, and there are many, with all that we have been talking about with TEAs. Oh, by the way, if you're not familiar, it means that you haven't been listening to our previous podcasts. So we've been discussing this to death. But still, I think it's important to take a couple of minutes just to give our listeners a quick history of the TEAs. Under the old law, and when I say old law, I mean what was enacted in 1990, previous to RIA, which was enacted last year in March of 2022, so there was quite a few years, it was actually the state that decided which location would fall under a TEA, a target employment area.
It's never changing, but Mona, you were part of one of the first regional centers in New York that was able to qualify under a TEA, right?
I was. That actually was New York City, and it was back in, 2007, and it was the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And at that time, the only RFE we got back from USAS was, who is going to decide where the TEA is? And at that time, it was Governor Patterson, who was the governor of New York, and he made a decision that it was going to be the Economic Development Council. But Rebecca, it wasn't the Economic Development Council everywhere, was it?
No, you know, it was state by state. Some had the economic development, the department that gave the TEA, or some you had to go, remember in Texas, we had to go to the governor at times to get a TEA. So it was easy in certain places like New York, Florida, California, for instance, was hard because you had to get 12 census tracts only, right? We're talking about only 12 census tracts.
Compare that to New York, where we had 40, 4-0. So there was a lot of gerrymandering. And that really was one of the driving forces for Senator Grassley and Leahy, who spearheaded the RIA and who made it very difficult to get a TEA. And now we're at a situation where it's USCIS who decides what a TEA is. And who helps us? Well, it's our good old economist.
Yes. And so we are seeing some changes. And so we have today with us a well-known EB5 economic consulting firm, Vermilion. We want to say welcome to Chris Atterbury and Ian Perry.
Hey, Rebecca, it's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you both for joining. Chris Atterbury is one of the founding partners of Vermilion Consulting. He's a seasoned leader with a rich background in military service. A retired Air Force colonel, Chris has experience in business development, mathematical modeling, and disaster relief. His distinguished career spans roles from a B-1B bomber pilot to deputy director for humanitarian assistance. Today, he leverages extensive experience to drive success at Vermilion Consulting. And joining him as co-pilot is Ian Perry. He's a managing partner of Vermilion Consulting and brings his expertise as an economic analysis. With a focus on EB5 compliant analysis and business plans, Ian has facilitated over $1 billion, billion with a B, in EB5 capital for diverse projects. Together, they steer Vermilion Consulting. Armed with decades of proven experience, their keen economic acumen is a formidable asset to any EB5 project that is looking for competitive clarity, economic enlightenment, and is focused on actionable achievements. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Mark. Good to meet you. And Mona, I should have said hi to you earlier, too. It's great to talk to you.
Great. All right. We now know, because of the new law, why TEA is so important. We're not going to get into set-asides and the amount being 800 or a million. We just know that that's very, very important, especially for anybody who's from one of the backlog countries like India or China. I'm going to ask you guys, first of all, the TEA, were you, first of all, inundated when the changes first happened from people who are asking you, what is a TEA, what is not a TEA?
It wasn't just RIA. This all goes back to when the program sunsetted, and we had all these different ideas that congressional staffers were kicking around. And we had clients calling us every time somebody came up with a new idea about how to designate a TEA. Clients would say, okay, can you run this one for us? Just hypothetically, would our project work under this particular brainchild or that brainchild? And yeah, it went on and on. And finally, when RIA came into play, and honestly, this still hasn't really put the whole issue to bed because we still need to wait for USCIS to issue the regulation. But at least the law makes it pretty clear now what a TEA is supposed to look like. And yes, it's been quite busy. Ian?
Yeah, we've been very busy, especially with the new data getting released next month. We've got a little bit of a queue going, waiting for more and more projects to come in and ask us to update their TEA letters. But looking forward to getting all that out of the way and just staying busy in the meantime.
Well, I think we're guilty of keeping you guys busy because we have a lot of last minute stuff in. But the last minute stuff is something we really wanted to discuss here, because we are seeing the end of what's called the COVID effect. We would love to hear your opinions as to why what Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy worked so hard for, which was to eliminate big cities like New York City, why that is still a TEA. A lot of New York is still a TEA.
So a TEA's qualifying threshold is 150% of the national average, which means that in order for a census tract to qualify, its unemployment needed to increase faster than the national average did. And it seemed like big cities, anecdotally at least, were hit harder than rural areas. I believe that may have had something to do with the generous unemployment policies that more urban areas tended to have, or more liberal states, if you will, since unemployment tends to be at a state level rather than a city level.
New York City really had a bad time during COVID, and I think the unemployment level was really high.
Absolutely. So New York in particular got hit really hard and their unemployment skyrocketed. And so some areas that pre-COVID may not have qualified because their unemployment was still below the national average then did qualify with COVID. And over the last year or two, we've seen the unemployment start to gradually come back down to pre-COVID levels. So the new data that's going to be released on December 7th by the Census Bureau is the 2022 ACS data. So we're going to start to see the unemployment levels overall start to come back down to the normal 3-5% level.
Do you think you're going to see that everywhere, Ian? Or is it going to are you going to see that in New York City first and then it'll slowly hit other cities? How fast do you think? I mean, we're only a few weeks away from December 7th. Do you think it's going to hit strong in all these these COVID data? Are we going to see a major change as of December 7th?
It's hard to say exactly what the data will look like. Really impossible to say because there are no periodic updates between data releases from the Census Bureau. So the last data release was in December last year, and that was the 2021 data. With this 2022 data that's going to come out, ACS is kind of a black box. We don't really know how they calculate it or how they come to their numbers, but that's what we have and that's what we use. In general, cities tend to have, and more urban areas tend to have higher unemployment than rural areas anyway, and definitely higher than more suburban areas. New York City just has a higher chance of continuing to qualify, not as a whole, but in their specific pockets of census tracts.
Yeah. Rebecca, didn't we see a lot of places lose their TEA status back in April? Ian, which data was changed in April?
This is has become sort of an ongoing issue with USCIS is in April, the census share data set is the one that updated. And Census Chair is one of the two available data sets that we have at our disposal. Census Chair is created by us economists, and using the prescribed methodology from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, in order to take the ACS data, which is published at a census tract level, and combine it with the more up-to-date LAUS data, which comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So what happened in April is the LAUS data, which is published at a county level, was released for 2022. We were able to combine that with the 2021 ACS data at the census tract level in order to come up with census tract level data for 2022.
For our listeners, if they're not familiar with how the TEA it currently works, perhaps Ian, you or Chris, just quickly outline what do you mean by the data and how does the data really affect whether something is a TEA or not? Because I thought it was USCIS who now decided. Is it not USCIS? Is it these data places?
It is USCIS, but they have to use the same data that we use. The only difference post-RIA and pre-RIA is pre-RIA, we would use this exact same data that we're using now, except we had to get the individual state to sign off on a TEA letter. They had to write their own. Now, post-RIA, the state is no longer involved. So it's the same data, but we as economists are allowed to write the letters that get submitted to USCIS. And then USCIS looks at our letter and they essentially check our math or the data that we're presenting against the data that is published online by the Census Bureau and the BLS.
And that's why you guys are very important, because you're now signing off the TEA letters. Mona, bringing it back to, like you said, we had data changing back in April. Now we're seeing data changing in December. We were lucky enough with some projects who were able to get under the TEA data analysis under the December rule change. Chris, Ian, is this something that we have to do every April, every December? You know, under the new rules, obviously, we know that once you file your I-956F, your TEA will remain a TEA for 2 years. But what about those projects who are in the midst of trying to get their data and then trying to get to this timeline? Are they lucky enough to wait till April now again? Or do you think they have to file by December?
Having these two different data updates, December and April, does seem like a hassle. And I know a lot of people feel that way, but it's actually a good thing because it represents the fact that there are two data sets that we can use now. Back when the states were doing the designations, it was almost always what Ian referred to as census share. If you were going to get a letter from the state, you had to use, in almost every case, you had to use census share. Now we have this other data set, the one that updates in December, and it gives us more flexibility in being able to qualify TEAs. So yeah, it is a pain, as you guys know, rushing to try to beat this December deadline, because nobody really knows the black box that Ian referred to earlier. Nobody knows what the December data is going to look like. And then really the same thing happens again in April. So what we're telling all of our clients now is, just because we've done an analysis for you, you need to stay on top of it, because we can't keep track of everybody's projects. A lot of times somebody will pop up and ask us for a TEA, and then we don't hear again from them for 6 months. Clients need to make sure that they're watching the release dates, and as one approaches, like December, come back to us and ask us, once the thing is clicked over, once the new data has been released, let us tell them whether it qualifies or not. So if one doesn't qualify on December 8th, for instance, that sounds like bad news, but there will be more data coming out again in April. And so then there's another chance for us to qualify it with the April data. So you may be sort of on again, off again with this new system that we're living in.
Chris, does it matter whether or not you use IMPLAN, Redyne, or RIMS2, you know, all of the methodologies that you use, does it matter as far as the data is concerned for TEA?
No, those are completely separate. That's a great question. The methods or the models that you just referred to are what we use for job creation, but they have nothing to do at all with targeted employment areas. The TEA data comes from the Census Bureau in December and from the Bureau of Labor Statistics in April. So there's no connection at all with the different RIMS, IMPLAN, Redyne, and TEAs.
So Mona, you know, we have some projects that are guilty of waiting that 6 or 8 month period, thinking they have enough time to file that they'll get the TEA. But here we are months later, and we're still in a rush period trying to file those cases. So yeah, we do urge, and I think this is a great conversation to have, to kind of remind projects that, hey, you have to get on the ball, because if you don't, you could potentially lose out on that TEA.
Right. I totally agree. I'm going to ask Ian and Chris, is there any alternative or legitimate data sources that could be used if these projects do miss the TEA?
Not really. Again, referring back to the pre-RIA days, many of the states had their own data sets that they generated internally. Other states actually used the Census Bureau information that we use. But now, post-RIA, since so few projects have actually been approved, we have very little data right now about what USCIS is accepting and what they're not accepting. And so in conjunction with our peer economists, there are several other firms that we speak to on a regular basis because we want to make sure we're all on the same page. We are all using just the two data sets that we've referred to. And so if a client gets bad news about a data set one, then we will run the TEA with data set two. But if that's bad news also, unfortunately, that's kind of the end of the road.
Well, we haven't seen any adjudications as yet relating to this. We haven't heard from many of our colleagues of anyone getting challenged by USCIS. I think it's too early to see. But even if they did challenge you, what would they challenge you on?
Well, there has actually been a challenge recently, and I won't go into specifics of who and what and why. But the census share methodology has come under fire in Annoyed. The gist of it is that a little history here. You know, when the program sunsetted, USCIS had to reassign many of its people to other departments and other branches of the government, other parts of the executive branch. And a lot of collective corporate experience was lost.
That's a nice way of putting it. I think we would use stronger language.
And we have too, but I'm going to be polite here. They had to hire a bunch of new people. And the new people have no historical background, and they don't understand that the census share methodology has been around for decades. And it was actually the method that is held up by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as the most accurate one to use. It's got its problems, but it's still a perfectly good methodology. And like I said, it's been around for a long time. It's coming under fire because mathematically, it's a little bit more complicated than the other data set. And frankly, I just don't think the adjudicators want to deal with it. And we're pushing back, and our fellow economists in other companies are doing the same.
Well, there aren't too many of you out there, so and people who really do understand. We've actually come across a few economists who are not EB-5 economists, and they really have no real understanding. So it's not recommended to go to someone who's not familiar with EB-5. Just wanted to plug that in, Rebecca, right?
100% agree. I want to ask, what about, I mean, you know, we do this as well. There are online TEA maps. How accurate are those? Are those good to just get a preliminary knowledge of whether or not it's a TEA or a rural area? How do you guys feel about those maps that are out there?
And before you answer that, I do want to tell you that we have taken several addresses and we've gone to maps and got different results. Mm-hmm. They have not been consistent.
A lot of times with those free websites or free maps that you find online, they're not necessarily the most up-to-date. There's no real accountability in those, so there's no way of knowing if they're actually using the proper methodology anyway.
You mean that if they get it wrong, we can't sue them, whereas if we retain you and you get it wrong, we can sue you.
Oh, wow. Shots fired.
I know. Only kidding, guys.
I think we always advise our clients that, look, you know, because they'll come to us and say, hey, I've looked it up. It's a TEA. And we're saying, well, let's wait a second. We always come to you guys. We get a report done to be absolutely sure it is a TEA.
Absolutely. And before you put in millions, hundreds of thousands of dollars, you do want to make sure it is actually a TEA. And again, Rebecca, why is it so important to be a TEA now? And we're not just talking about the $250,000 difference.
Yeah, well, it's because of the set-asides. And that's going to be very, very important for those who are Indian-born, China-born, who are in backlog under the old program. So having a TEA project, because they're part of the set-aside, you can now kind of jump the line and have a visa available and ready to get a green card.
Which brings us to my questions to Ian and Chris on rural data, because rural locations were given a higher set aside than TEA, and yet we are seeing a lot less rural projects. So I don't know, Chris, Ian, if you are seeing the same. Anyway, let me ask you something. Just like the TEA locations change with the data, is there any data set there which will take a project away from rural?
The rural qualification has two components. The first one is that the project needs to sit in a county that is outside of a metropolitan statistical area. It can sit in a micropolitan statistical area. So metro is bad for rural, micro is good.
Sorry, Ian, can you translate that into English?
Yes. Sure, yes. The abbreviation MSA is usually what gets thrown around, but since they're both MSA, we have to specify metro versus micro. That qualification is published by the Office of Management and Budget. That is changed up periodically. It hasn't been a regular publication. So the most recent one happened this year in 2023. The MSAs got updated. And when they did that, only a couple dozen or so counties changed their metro micro status, where some counties may have moved from micro to metro and some counties may have moved from metro to micro. But overall, they're mostly the same as they were previously. Before that, the last publications of a list of counties in their MSAs was 2020, and before that it was 2018 and 2017 and 2015 and 2013. So it's not at any regular interval, it's just something we have to keep an eye on. I did mention there are two components, though. The second component will not change until 2030, because the second component is based on the population of the town that the project is in. And that population has to be less than 20,000 people as specified by the most recent decennial census.
Rebecca, you were right. Rebecca always believes that the rural TEA designations, or rather the rural designations, is less volatile.
Yes,
it is. It doesn't change every year. The population changes once every 10 years, and the MSAs can change every couple years or so, but not with any regularity.
Yeah, that's why rural is popular. But again, we don't see as many rural projects as we have seen the TEA projects.
We have a large cross-section of clients, and actually we are seeing lots of rural. In fact, people will pursue rural, and if they don't find that their project is in a rural location, sometimes they don't even want us to check to see if it's in a high unemployment TEA because of the set-aside business that Rebecca was talking about.
Yeah, I think we do have more urban clients, Rebecca. That's why we don't see as much rural.
Yes.
Although lately we are seeing more ski resort type projects.
And those are generally in rural areas. So that's
Well, you can't go wrong with a ski resort.
Exactly. That's where the money is. And you want your project to be successful. And in order to be successful in a rural area, there has to be money there.
Right.
Yeah.
That is definitely not what Grassley and Leahy wanted to see happen.
That's right.
Yeah. They wanted the real, true rural areas. Mm-hmm. But Mona, you know, like we were talking about, you and I were having a conversation on remote workers. And Ian, Chris, we wanted to know, you know, moving away from the TEA, now going into actual job creation. With COVID happening, we are seeing a lot of remote or hybrid workers. Does this have an effect on job creation when it comes to the regional center?
This one's tricky because it really is a gray area, and it is different from project to project. So I know of two projects that have very different outcomes with this question. These are both regional center projects, not direct investor. Mm-hmm. There was one project many years ago that wanted to build a large commercial development in an urban area. And there was no way we could get the TEA to work, even using the old rules, which were much more permissive than what we would deal with now. You know, we could have put together 40 tracts if we had wanted to, but we just couldn't get that track to work. And so the client wanted it, and it was, I guess they were trying to do some problem solving. They said, well, what if we set up the construction trailer in the next census tract over. And because it was a rural, an urban environment, that just meant across the street. Across the street was a different tract. What if we set up our contractor facility over there? Could we count that as the TEA, as the place where the job creation was happening? And we advised them, no, there's really no way that you could convince USCIS that the jobs were being created in a trailer. The jobs are really being created on the job site, and there's just no way around it. So that's not really the same thing as remote workers, but it kind of heads in that direction. What if there are activities outside of the TEA? Can you count them? So in that case, we said no, and the client wasn't happy with the answer. And I don't know whatever happened with the project, but we were not involved in it anymore. Mm-hmm. A different example, a project that, and I don't remember if it was rural TEA or it was probably a high unemployment, but it was a company that provided home healthcare services. And what they were going to do is they were going to use their EB-5 capital to significantly increase their workforce, the nurses that would go out to homes throughout the region and provide the services that they provide. And in that case, we decided, we in conjunction with the client and USCIS eventually agreed that the job creation happened not in those individual homes where the home healthcare workers were going to go and, you know, help elderly people with their daily tasks, but rather that the job creation happened in the headquarters. Even though that's not where people were working, that was the sort of the nerve center, the brain of the operation, and that was the location where the TEA was pronounced.
I find that interesting because, you know, when you hear regional centers, you automatically think, well, you just have to take the expenditures, do the calculation, and you come up with a job number, right? But you never think about how it affects, like, where you're actually located, you know, because they do ask you the location of the actual NCE, where's the JCE, where's the actual project happening? And Mona, we've seen this, we've told clients as well that even though we've used a regional center model, you still need to show that location, and that location is where the job creation is happening. It's just not about the expenditures. I mean, that's important, but it's also about where are those jobs coming from?
I agree. And Chris, to go back to your point, that example about the trailer, we have seen RFEs where USCIS has come back, but this is mostly for entrepreneur projects, where they have said, we don't see how 10 people can fit in an office of, you know, this size. I mean, it's got to be credible at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
But you can't get away from this remote working. And again, with the entrepreneur projects, because they're operational, you do have the hybrid and the remote possibilities now, which weren't there before. It is going to be an issue, I think, moving forward, because people will try and, for want of a better word, gerrymander the TEAs in order to make the set-asides.
Yeah, I agree with you, Mona. I see issues happening if you're trying to get a TEA area. However, I don't see why it would affect those that are non-TEA or non-rural projects, because at the end of the day, you're not trying to get that lower amount. And so I feel like wherever you create the jobs, you've created jobs. Does it really need to be in that region per se? I think that's something I would make an argument for, but I definitely agree with you on the TEA.
Rebecca, I think you're absolutely right. If we get away from the TEA altogether and we're just talking about the $1 million investments, then it shouldn't matter. I don't remember ever hearing anyone, you know, worried that that was going to be a problem with USCIS. Job creation is job creation. And if it's not, well, there is no TEA, so you can't say whether it's inside or outside.
Exactly.
Well, again, I keep saying that the most important person after the immigration lawyer is the economist, because you're dealing with almost every aspect of these EB-5 petitions. We're not going to go into 829s today, but there's a lot to discuss on that, because I know, Rebecca, you want to mention something which is an area you're dealing with right now.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, there's so much with the I-829s. But before we get into that, as we have Chris and Ian here, we're now seeing economists coming in for the end of the year compliance. So the I-956G compliance, which used to be the I-924As, we're now seeing...
For regional centers, right?
Yes, for regional centers. We're now seeing they're kind of, you know, like someone said, it's almost filing a mini I-829. But Chris, Ian, you know, you're also inundated with that as well, because that is coming up. How are you guys handling it? Because it's per project as well, because the USCIS regulations or in the form itself specifically requests direct job creation for these NCEs.
Yeah, so we think that's a little bit of an oversight. So we're not just reporting direct job creation for each project. We're reporting the total job creation, which includes indirect as well. And just we're going to blast them with the information and they can decide what they actually want. But we are taking in requests to get these job calculations done. We're putting together an annual report, just like we did in previous years for the 924As, where the job creation in the fiscal year was required. Now they want the job creation from the project inception. So it's important that we get the actual expenditures and the actual revenue since the project started through September 30th, which is the end of the government fiscal year.
Yeah, so it's a lot more work, I feel. I mean, we're lucky enough that we're in the beginning, and we thought, you know, at first, only projects that maybe file under the new regulations. What we're doing is making sure we're filing for every project. So whether you filed under the old regulations or you filed under RIA 2022, we're telling everyone, if you didn't file an I-829, go ahead and get that jobs report.
Yeah, and that's definitely what we're seeing with our other clients too. You guys are following along the same thought process, is that let's just be safe and qualify or report on all of the projects that are active. What Ian was talking about since inception is it's really important for regional centers to stay very closely tied with the developer and make sure that you're getting regular updates throughout the project's lifetime, because now you're not, you know, you need to report on it every single year. And each time you get a data dump from your developer, you're adding more and more information that will eventually you're going to need for the 829 anyway. So these are mini 829s and they're good practice for the ultimate 829.
One of the issues which came out of RIA was the fact that there had to be a certain percentage of direct jobs. And this really bothered everybody in the beginning, because there were so many regional center projects, for example, condominium developments, etc., where there really was very few direct jobs. Chris, are you seeing that there is an issue showing that percentage of direct jobs in projects? And I'm going to ask you that question. Are you actually seeing real jobs?
Okay, it's two answers there. Since RIA, we have done, I don't have the number at my fingertips, but I would say we've probably done somewhere between 30 and 50 actual projects. And I don't think we have really run into one yet where the percentage issue became a problem. Really what we see most of the time for conventional construction, commercial real estate type projects, is it's pretty darn close to 50-50, 50% direct, 50% indirect. You only get into trouble if your direct numbers are really low, like if you're 10% direct and 90% indirect. But we honestly haven't really seen that yet. We're very careful about it. We spell out in detail what it is that we're doing in our reports so that the adjudicator understands that we understand. It hasn't really been a problem yet. Now, your second part is interesting. For us economists, we deal with models, and the numbers that come out of our models are not the kinds of jobs where you could go and walk into an office building and touch somebody on the nose and say, ah, I see your number 125 in the direct column. These are just numbers. And because Congress wisely decided not to do away with economic modeling, you know, we do things the way we did before RIA. These are not the kind of direct jobs that you would see in the entrepreneurial segment, the direct investors, where they actually go out, hire people, 10 people at a minimum, and then have to prove at the 829 that those 10 people were lawful U.S. citizens with all the documentation that needs to go with them. So I'm fudging a little bit on the second one. I don't want to say these aren't real jobs, but they're not jobs that you can go out and physically count.
Yeah, that was one of the issues that Senator Grassley raised several times, that these aren't real jobs. But they really are, because there is an economic impact. They had just, it's just logical that there is. And I think the ability to be able to count that, all those indirect jobs, whatever methodology you use, just shows just how many jobs this program does create.
I agree, very much so.
Well, Chris, you know, I found that really interesting. I thought it would have been harder to obtain, you know, direct numbers versus indirect and induced jobs. You know, there's so many more issues coming in as we discuss remote workers. Now we're getting into, you know, is there gig economies with 1099 workers, you know, all of that. So, you know, Mona and I would love to have you, Ian, the team from Vermilion back on for another episode.
We'd certainly be happy to join you again, and that'll be an interesting discussion because we are seeing different types of projects post-RIA. A lot of the projects in the earlier phase were all commercial real estate before RIA was enacted, but we are seeing more unusual projects now, and so maybe we'll have more things to talk about on that topic next time.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Thank you so much for both of you coming on. It's been enlightening.
Well, thank you, too. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshawlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.